Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. In this week's programme, we hear some tall tales from the UK's very first storytelling laureate. We interview a writer whose first novel is being hailed as one of the publishing events of the year, even though it was originally rejected by every major US publisher. But first, the second of five authors shortlisted for this year's Guardian First Book Award describes an encounter with some of Nigeria's oil bandits.
By now, the river is dark, and we are navigating by a combination of the boat driver's torch and Godson's hand signals. We pass villages where the only light is from oil lamps and the occasional generator-powered electric bulb. Beyond them is a ghostly orange glow behind the tree line. It is the oil company gas flares, burning constantly as if in some cruel experiment in sleep deprivation. By the time we reach Korokorose, the boat is quiet, through a combination of our physical tiredness and immersion in our own thoughts. As we jump onto land once again, Willie, one of our guides, offers me an unnerving parting shot that echoes Comrade's observation about who is the most responsible for the Delta's troubles. It is as if deep beneath the anger and ruthlessness of these militants lurks a sense of inferiority and even self-loathing, founded on centuries of exploitation and grotesque power relationships. "If white people like you had been in charge, there would be no problem," Willie says, "because you are not dubious. But we Nigerians are dubious." Once ashore, we are asked to wait in a bar on the main street of the village while our guides sort out somewhere for us to stay. Inside, young men are drinking beer and soft drinks to a soundtrack of loud music and a generator's hum. There isn't much chatter, partly because of the booming sound system, and partly because the arrangement of chairs around the sides of the room gives it a gladiatorial feel. Glenn and I start talking to some of the young men, one of whom suggests kidnapping one of us and splitting the ransom 50-50. The question of ransom payments for oil workers is one of the great open secrets of the Delta. No one believes the official line that they are never paid. The previous week, I'd asked an oil company executive how ransom demands were settled. He replied, "No comment. But we do not pay ransoms." When I asked if the government paid the ransoms for the multinationals, he said, with insouciance, "Pass." My neighbour in the bar, crew leader Henry Emmanuel, says he has no job and has taken up arms to make things better. He says he doesn't know the international oil price exactly, but he knows lots of people are making a great deal of money out of Nigeria. "When government does the things the way we want, we will drop our weapons and follow our path in society," he says. The longer we stay in the bar, the edgier the mood becomes. A powerfully built man in a red t-shirt comes in, looks at us a little suspiciously, and leaves again. Shortly afterwards, we hear the sound of an argument outside. Glenn and I go out, where we see the man in the red t-shirt berating Simeon. When we appear, the man turns his fury on us, despite Glenn's best attempts to placate him. It seems we and our guides have misjudged the terrain. We are not as welcome here as we had thought. As we retreat inside, red t-shirt man follows, continuing to berate us. He shouts about how people are suffering, his wife is suffering, and he can't see his children because the police are looking for him. "That's why he kidnaps white people," he says. "He's been told we are journalists, not spies." "That is the only thing," he shouts, "that is saving you people."
Michael Peel reading from A Swamp Full of Dollars, the only work of non-fiction to reach the shortlist of this year's Guardian First Book Award. Michael, welcome. Now, I describe these young men as bandits. Is that strictly fair?
I think the way to look at them is as really people who have a portfolio of interests and motivations. And you've got to take the long view on this and look back to over the 50 years of oil production in Nigeria and the sort of long arc of initial hope and expectation about what oil would bring to the country, to the current state of where people feel betrayal and disappointment and see that they've received little or nothing in terms of benefits and only pollution and other drawbacks as a result. And what
what that means is that you've had opposition to the oil industry going back a number of years, which initially was very focused on this this anger, this moral case, if you like, for what had happened. But over time, like other resistance movements we've seen in history, it's veered off in different directions, and particularly in later years, as more and more arms have been piled up in the Delta, as politicians have set up militias to help rig elections, suddenly people have realized, well, you know, we have arms, we have power, we can do a bit of freelance racketeering ourselves. And so they take oil from pipelines, sell it on the black market, or kidnapping, for example, has become less a way to make an ideological point against the oil industry, but more of an industry. And so over time, the ideology has blended with mercantilism, a certain spirituality as well, to create what we see today. So yes, they are bandits, but they are other things as well.
Functioning within a sort of authorised banditry.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the very striking things about the Niger Delta is the way that, well, on the surface, it looks like this totally chaotic, lawless state within a state. In fact, you realise that beneath the surface is this very complex texture of relationships, and that alliances are constantly being made and broken, and that the parties to the conflict know each other a lot better than you might expect as an outsider. The militants have contacts in the oil companies, who in turn employ some of these militants on security contracts. Government people have relationships with these militias. Sometimes the militias have taken up arms because they've fallen out with the political leaders, and so on.
Mm. Now, there's a shocking subtext here, which is about the connivance of Western companies and Western governments, indeed. Mm. In this corruption.
Yes, I mean, I very much...
It's not even a subtext, really, is it?
No, it's sort of uber-text.
Uber-text. Yeah,
I think that's right. I mean, for me, this is a sort of Orient Express-style story. You know, everyone did it. And there's a whole chapter where I interview a senior executive from Shell who makes various justifications about the way the company has conducted it itself. And there's a line there about how, look, we're just the operator here. You know, it's a very revealing line which shows a certain sort of amorality, really, an ability and a willingness to operate within a system which I would argue, you know, has become totally corrupted and has manifestly failed the Nigerian people over the 50 years it has operated. And, you know, so you have this, it's not a conspiracy in an organized sense, but this confluence of interests, this sort of dirty little secret almost, which suits the oil companies, it suits the government officials who make money off the back of it. It suits some of the militants now who are exploited. But meanwhile, of course, the vast mass of people are the ones who suffer.
You track an ex-state governor, corrupt state governor, back to his flat just off Edgware Road, where he was found to have £1 million or dollars, was it?
Yes.
Stashed away in dressing gown pockets.
Only about 915,000.
Oh, only 915,000.
But that's a pretty extraordinary case. And that really shows how, you know, this is not something remote or abstract happening in a faraway place, but something that for all sorts of reasons touches this country.
And the banks were actually laundering his money for him, weren't they?
Well, they certainly took his money without asking enough questions. I think that's clear from some of the evidence that I quote, and there are some emails which I quote from one banker in which they talk about, you know, this governor, and one of them says that, you know, he's a man of sort of great respectability, and that, you know, he's taken on this governorship in this Nigerian state for the good of his people, and, you know, there's a sort of a complete willingness to buy whatever story he has told them there, and I think that, you know, that's a really important point to make, because this kind of stuff isn't supposed to happen anymore. You know, 10 years ago, there was the whole furore about more than £1 billion of money stolen by the Nigerian regime of Sani Abacha, which made its way into this country, and new rules were introduced, and it was a kind of never again scenario. But, you know, here it is happening, you know, within the past few years.
Mm. Now, you obviously put yourself in some danger on several occasions to research this book. Was that unique? That particular encounter with those bandits?
Yeah, that was certainly one of the tenser moments. I think that there's a sort of curious sort of paradox in Nigeria, really, that for all of the fact that if you're hanging out with guys with guns, clearly there is a certain sort of nervousness there, and things can go wrong. And I describe a couple of occasions there where in the chapter where, you know, because people were drunk or tanked up, you know, I did feel fear. But on the other hand, militants are generally very savvy about how the world works, how the international media works, and they realise that kidnapping journalists or beating them up or killing them is not the way to get to good publicity for their cause. And there's a real awareness of that which sort of underpins what's going on, which is not to say that individuals can't sort of put the frighteners on you, but their kind of media savviness for me was highlighted by an incident I quote in that chapter where we went past this toilet, which was basically just a medieval-style hole lead onto the river, and the militant guy we were with said, you know, look, this is where we have to use the toilet, and he looked at us and rather disappointedly and said, well, next time you must bring cameras, and there was a sense of that sort of pervading the whole thing.
But the danger isn't only from sinister people, it's also from actually just making your way around the cities, and you have rather sort of hair-raising exploits on the back of an Okada, don't you? Explain what an Okada is.
Again, that's another very interesting point. An Okada is a motorcycle taxi, basically, and in a society where, you know, over the years, there's been very little in the way of mass public transit. This whole freelance transport system has grown up, and it is a bit scary and hair-raising. There are lots of accidents involving Okadas, of course, most of which, you know, most harmful to the drivers themselves. There is a bit of a risk as a passenger, but it's also exhilarating, and you feel alive with the wind in your hair.
Yeah, you start off the book describing Nigeria as a basket case, and you end up actually enjoying it, don't you? There's a sort of sense of pleasure in the people and their resourcefulness.
Oh, absolutely. And I hope I didn't say it was a basket
they
case.
Were described. Yes.
I mean, I quoted that as, you know, a sort of characteristically dismissive view of this country, which really does have something to it in terms of the kind of zest of intellectual, physical, emotional with which people engage with life. And that's partly born of adversity and having to, you know, tough it out in a rough old place, but it's definitely there, and that's something I found hugely attractive. And frankly, and I've discussed this with Nigerian friends, in some ways I felt far safer walking the streets of Lagos than I do here sometimes in London, because if you're targeted by violence in Nigeria, it's because somebody wants something from you, maybe they're an armed robber or whatever. But what there is much less of is that threat of random drink-fueled violence, for example, that, you know, just because you look at someone in the wrong way, they might come after you. And so, you know, wandering around Lagos, I find, you know, almost all the time a very sociable, rewarding experience.
Now, why should somebody read this book who has no interest in Nigeria? Is it of general interest? Do you think, obviously, it's of interest to you as a reporter who worked in that area?
It takes on a big political subject, which I think is really a story of our times. It's about a world in which venality is open and naked. It's a world, and I'm talking about the oil industry in Nigeria rather than, you know, something singular about the country itself. It's about the changes oil has wrought. It's about that finality. It's about the reckless exploitation of resources without a thought for the future. It's about sort of excessive, unwise spending. And there's a chapter about how the country got into massive debts, egged on by the rest of the world during a time when oil prices were high, and suddenly they tanked. And
so, in fact, it's a story for all of us, really.
It is. And with the, you know, with the financial crisis here, it's brought it that much closer to home. And, you know, it's not so much that it's different, it's that the canvas is recognisable, it's just that everything is that much rawer and better defined. And I think the other important thing to say is that I hope people will enjoy this book just because it's a good read. It's not a dry, or not meant to be a dry, sort of analytical look at a place. It's a real engagement, a real passionate personal engagement with the multitude of brilliant stories I heard there and people that I met. And so, you know, if you have an eye for the intriguing, the mischievous, the unusual, the inspiring, the amusing, then I think there is something for you in this book.
Now, if any confirmation of that were needed, A Swampful of Dollars was described by one of our Waterstones reading groups, Oxford, I believe, as a necessary book. Thank you very much for joining us, Michael. A Swampful of Dollars is published by IB Taurus and is available from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. The winner of the 2009 Guardian First Book Prize will be announced on December the 2nd, and we'll hear from another of the authors on next week's programme. This month saw the appointment of the first storytelling laureate. His name is Taffy Thomas, and he has a repertoire of more than 300 stories, tales, and elaborate lies, his words, which he says he is happy to tell in almost any situation. So we've tracked him down to his Lake District base and challenged him to tell us one over the phone that lasts no longer than 2 minutes. Taffy, what's the name of this story?
The story is called The Talking Skull. Many years ago, kings and the gentry used to engage entertainers, and woe betide the entertainer who bored them. And so it was one day the king turned his jester and said, you haven't come up with any new material. Tomorrow, something new, or I will chop off your head. The poor jester, he went out of the castle. Just outside the castle, on the grass, he discovered a shining white skull. He stroked his chin and he looked at the skull and said, what brought you here? To his amazement, the skull answered, talking brought me here. And the jester went, whoopee! I found something new to entertain my king. And he ran back into the castle. He said, sir, discovered something new, a talking skull. The courtiers all laughed at the jester for thinking that a skull could speak. But the king was fascinated. He said, show me. And they all trailed in a line out of the castle to where the white skull was there on the ground. They made a circle around. The king said, make it speak. The jester looked down and said, talk to me. The skull said nothing. The courtiers laughed. This time they were laughing at the king for believing the jester. The king didn't like being laughed at. He drew his sword and he sliced off the jester's head. The head fell to the ground and settled next to the skull. They dragged the corpse away. Seconds later, the skull turned to the severed head of the jester and said, and what brought you here? The answer, of course, was talking brought me here. And talking brought me, Taffy Thomas, here and led to me being the first National Laureate for Storytelling.
We ought to clap, really, wouldn't we? Taffy, that's a bit shorter than your usual story, isn't it? What length do you think?
Yes, I was having to think to make it that short, but I also think that story works, like a lot of my stories, on several levels. I mean, you will all in there realise it's also a story about editors and deadlines.
Yes, Sarah's fingering her neck anxiously at this very moment. Sarah Crown, our website editor. So tell us how you got into storytelling.
Well, I've always been interested in stories, ever since having a grandfather who, he would never have said he was a storyteller, but he loved talking and talking to people, and people remember their heritage, their history, as stories. So if I ever asked him anything about when he was young, he would tell me it as a story. I held on to it and started to get interested in folk tales, and used them with my puppet theatre group, who were called Magic Lantern, back in the 1970s. Magic Lantern also did street entertainment, and I became a fire eater. And I was a fire eater until 25 years ago, when I suffered a massive stroke at the age of 35. Following that, I had no speech for 3 months. And I used storytelling to learn to speak again.
It's a wonderful story. Is it true, or is it one of your lies?
No, that is absolutely factual.
Is storytelling just for children?
Well, I hope I've already proved that it's not. I mean, I think that my repertoire is for the young and the young at heart. the great thing about storytelling is that it's truly intergenerational. My preferred audience would be to have in front of me grandparents, parents, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and to come up with a story that would cross all of those boundaries. In a storytelling session, whoever is there, the audience are just people. The age is irrelevant.
Now, Michael's still with us here, and obviously in West Africa, storytelling's a very big thing, isn't it? Did you encounter it?
Yeah, that's right. And especially as you go west and north towards the Sahara, there's this great tradition centered on the old Mali Empire of the so-called griots, who in countries like Senegal and Mali, Niger, and they're essentially combinations of wandering minstrels, oral historians, and storytellers. Some of them are attached to communities and reflect on births, deaths, and the great events of the community. Others are more peripatetic, and they are an extraordinary presence, which you see both in its traditional form and also in a much more modern way. They've influenced modern film, the films of Ousmane Sembène, great sort of descriptive films about life in Senegal and elsewhere in West Africa, with a real storyteller's eye for detail and the observation of the people within them and the way they behave. And also, if for instance, in the music of Youssou N'Dour, whose mother was a griot, I believe, and he's talked about how that was an influence and in his musical career.
Did you ever come across tradition I know that exists in various African countries of dilemma stories? Now, this is a great thing which really proves that storytelling is a truly interactive medium, because the dilemma stories are a story which pose a question, and then the audience actually debate it at the end of the story.
Yeah,
I
didn't see that.
Seen it happen.
Clearly, this is a lacuna in my African storytelling knowledge.
Sarah Crown, how does this relate to performance poetry, or to the increasing demand for any writer to be able to perform their own work, whatever form
it takes? It's interesting to sort of compare those two strands, I suppose, because if somebody says to you storytelling, you think of fairy tales, the kind of story that Taffy told us at the beginning, which was, you know, a story with a moral, a story with a point or a meaning. And then you look at sort of literature, poetry and novels, and as you said, it's something that more and more authors are being asked to do, and partly, to be honest, it's a kind of a publishing marketing drive a lot of the time. You have to, particularly children's authors, you have to be able to go out and go into schools all around the country and read your work and perform it. And you look at people like Owen Colfer, he ended up taking his book around as part of a stand-up routine. So there is obviously this hunger in us to watch authors perform. Poetry, I suppose, is my particular area of interest. And some of my best sort of spoken word experiences have been going and sitting in a dark room with a poet spot lit and reading out poetry. And you reach a sort of different level when you're listening to literature rather than reading it, I think, where you're kind of lulled and it's slightly hypnotic and you go somewhere else. I guess maybe it's like listening to music. And perhaps that's why storytelling, the act of storytelling, is so important to us, because it takes us off somewhere else.
It
reminds me of being little, I think, being read to.
It makes it a very social art, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Especially if you have a storyteller which hopefully, like myself, is prepared to allow the performance to be interrupted by comment. I mean, hesitating to use the word heckling, because I actually mean, you know, something far more profound than heckling, although that's good as well, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've worked with hospice staff, apart from your usual school visits. What use would a storyteller have in a hospice?
Well, storytelling, I hope we've proved today, is a de-stressing and relaxing thing to happen. People don't go to hospices to die. They go to hospices to live until they die. And if the arts are about improving the quality of life, then there's nowhere really that greater effort should be made to do that than with people who are life limited.
Yes, no, absolutely. Now, your reward for this onerous undertaking, which is a 2-year appointment, I believe, isn't
it? 2 years to me, and then it will continue. Somebody else will inherit the talking.
What is it? A mantle, a jester's cap?
Well, the conch or the
the conch. What? Tell. You didn't get a butt of sack, did you? You got a very, very special cargo.
Somebody actually emailed me and said if If the poet laureate of Carol Ann gets a butt of sack, then the storyteller laureate should get a jug of unicorn's milk.
And what I've read from your...
I think is a really wonderful email to have got.
It's fantastic. And what you actually got, according to somewhere I read, is a kilogram bag of dried beans, a simple compass, a packet of love hearts, a clear glass bottle, a tall white candle, a silver Lucky Charm bracelet and a whistle. There must be a story in that.
It's a challenge to me how I choose to use those gifts over the 2 years. Obviously, each one is going to either be linked to a story or a riddle. And I think as soon as I get the bag of dry beans, I've got to go and find somebody called Jack.
You can find out more about the new storytelling laureate, Taffy Thomas, MBE, if you please, from www.taffythomas.co.uk. And finally, on this week's programme, David Vann, whose new book, Legend of a Suicide, was described in The Guardian's Saturday Review as moving, readable and often bleakly funny. For once, said the reviewer Chris Taylor, its UK publishers' comparisons with the likes of Tom Wolfe and Richard Ford aren't misplaced. High praise indeed. Sarah Crown met David Vann to find out what all the fuss was about, and he began by reading a passage from the book.
I abandoned ship one night when my father was crying alone in the living room and my mother was breaking things in their bedroom. She didn't utter any human sounds, but I could chart her progress around their room by imagining the sources of wood snapping, glass shattering, and plaster crumbling. I slipped out into the soft, watery world of Alaskan rainforest night, soundless except for the rain, and wandered in my pajamas down the other side of the street, peering in dark, low living room windows and listening at doors, until at one door I heard a humming sound that was unfamiliar to me. I went around to the side of the house, opened the screen door, and pressed my ear to cold wood. The sound seemed lower now, almost a moan, barely audible. The door was locked, but I lifted up the rubber corner of the welcome mat, and just as at our house, the key was there, so I went in. I discovered that the buzzing sound was the air pump filter on a fish tank. Something about wandering alone through someone else's house was awful, and I moved solemnly across the linoleum to take a seat high on a kitchen stool. I watched the orange and black striped fish suck at pebbles and spit them out. The tank contained larger rocks also, lava rocks with dark caves and crannies, out of which peered many tiny round fish eyes, shiny as foil. Some had bright red and blue bodies, others had bright orange bodies. I thought perhaps the fish were hungry. I went to the refrigerator and saw sweet pickles, opened the jar, and brought it back for the fish to see. I found slots on top of the tank, toward the back, and dropped the pickles in, one or two at first, then the whole jar, slice by slice, and finally poured the juice in, too, so that the tank water swelled up and ran in beads over the side. I stared at the pickle slices floating brightly with the fish, some of them sinking and twirling. They bounced slowly over the bright pink and blue rocks below. The orange-striped fish had all flashed about the tank as I had been pouring, but they, too, now moved slowly. They leaned a little to one side as they swam, and several rested on the rocks. Others stretched their long, see-through cartilage mouths at the surface every few moments and sucked for air. Their side fins rippled as delicately as fine lace. When the pickle slices had settled more, they rocked like sleeping fish just above the pink and blue gravel, and the real fish rocked silently beside them, as if in gentle groves of eelgrass and sunken lily pads. The image was beautiful, and in that moment of beauty I strained forward. I pressed my hands and face close to the glass and gazed into the mute black core of one of those silvery eyes. I felt as if I too were floating, gently rocking, oddly out of place, and in that flicker of a moment I caught myself feeling the rocking and perceiving myself perceiving, realized that I was I. This distracted me. Then I forgot what had distracted me, lost interest in the fish, and after slapping my feet across the linoleum of the kitchen floor, passed again into the soft, dark rain.
Okay, well, thanks so much for reading to us. I read Legend of a Suicide over the weekend, and I found it one of the most slippery, uncategorisable books I think I've read in a really long time. And I, obviously, knowing that I was coming to talk to you about it today, I've been trying to work out a way to summarise it, to come up with a way of, you know, explaining what it's about. Mm-hmm. And then I decided that's daft because you're coming in. So I wanted to ask you what you think it's about. And you must have been asked this question a lot, presumably, mm-hmm. for interviews like this. Can you sum it up? Can you give us the book summary?
Yeah, Legend of a Suicide is a series of portraits of my father and his suicide, his despair leading up to the suicide and my own bereavement. So the word legend in the suicide actually is legendary, as in the hagiographic tradition. Chaucer's Legend of Good Women was a piece that I was studying, and I ended up titling one of my stories A Legend of Good Men, because I realized that that series of portraits is a wonderful way to structure a story. I was talking about all the men that my mother dated after my dad died, all these potential replacements for my father, and they did seem to come in a series, and so that structure worked. And once I'd written that story, I realized that that structure actually applied to the work as a whole, because there are different and competing accounts here of what happened, which is how I really experienced it in real life, that they were competing in different accounts. Each one of us in the family had a different sense of why he had done it and of what had happened, and that together that series of portraits forms a kind of debate that tries to capture more fully what the experience was, more full than what one consistent narrative, a more standard novel, might be able to accomplish.
Okay, so you're describing it then as a series of portraits. This idea of structure is, again, something that's very interesting to me, because I read the book in the UK edition of the book, in which you're presented something that looks a lot like a novel. It's mm-hmm. it's a book with a series of chapters, and it takes you quite a long time as you're reading it to work out that this isn't a continuous narrative, that this is people's perceptions of what's been happening in different looks, different glances. Mm-hmm. In the US, I gather, it's been published as a collection of short stories, and I can see that the way in which it's published is going to make a huge difference to readers' perception of what's going on, because the act of reading, because of the way it was presented, was actually a very destabilizing one, because you're struggling to get your bearings as a reader to find mm-hmm. out where you are, and you're sort of lost in the wilderness like Roy and his father are mm-hmm. at certain points in the book. Mm-hmm. Did you have a preference in terms of the way in which it's published?
Yeah, I really prefer the way it's published here. I think that this is closer to what I imagined for the book, to number the chapters and present it as being something very close to a novel, because I think it's closer to being a novel than it is to being a collection of short stories. And in the U.S., I actually asked the publisher not to put short stories on it, and so they didn't. So it's just published as nothing there. It just has the title and my name, and it doesn't say what it is. So I actually think that this is better to number the chapters, because they do serve like chapters of a book. There really is an arc overall. They're supposed to be read in this order and together, and none of them make full sense without the others. They really don't. Although they've been published individually, they don't actually fully stand on their own. They gain their full meaning when they're in debate with the others.
And another difference, I gather, again, between the UK edition of the book and the US edition of the book is that at the beginning of the book, it's dedicated to your father and it gives his dates, 1940 to 1980. But no explicit mention is made of his suicide until the afterword, whereas in the US edition, it's made clear at the front that this is a book that's drawn from your experience of your father's suicide. How hard was it to discuss such a personal and painful issue?
Well, it took me 10 years to write the book, so it was very difficult for me. My first 3 or 4 years were just failed stories with too much emotion and no distance and no way of telling the story. It was just an impossible mess, and I ended up having to cut all of them. And it was only through other authors that I was able to gradually find ways to tell parts of the story. So for the first story, Ichthyology, Elizabeth Bishop and Marilyn Robinson. For the long novella in it, Cormac McCarthy and William Faulkner. I was reading 6 novels by those two as I was sailing offshore with my laptop strapped to my knees with Velcro, and I wrote most of it in 17 days. So although I took 10 years to write the book, I wrote most of the longest part of it in 17 days, and the first story I wrote in 2 days. It was a process of bereavement, basically, of trying to understand, and also of investigation, trying to cut through all the family guilt and shame and lies and my own deceptions of myself and others, and it was really messy, and the writing often went places that I didn't expect it to go, and so the huge surprise that happens in the middle of the novella, for instance, I didn't find out myself that was going to happen until that clause inside that sentence. I was already partway through the sentence before I realized what was going to happen, and then I just couldn't believe it. It was such an extreme change in how everything would go. And I hadn't seen it coming at all. But once it happened, I saw that it was perfect for how I felt and for what the shape of the story really was for me, and that that's what I've been writing toward all along.
The central story, the what you call the novella, I guess, it begins with Roy and his father, and Roy is your alter ego, landing up on an uninhabited island in the Bering Strait and sort of homesteading, basically, setting themselves up. A really significant aspect of the story, it seemed to me, was your description of the place itself, of Alaska. Was it a difficult place to wrestle into words?
I do find it easy to describe Alaska because, for me, it's the mythic landscape. It's where I spent my early childhood, and so when I was 4 years old, I was running around out in the rainforest, imagining that I was being chased by wolves and bears, and we really had wolves and bears. It's a wonderful and rich place for me to write from, and it was easy to try to describe what's happening inside these characters' lives through that external landscape, through that wilderness. And that's what I've returned to, actually, in a novel that I've written now, Caribou Island, which will come out next fall.
Well, I wanted to ask you, actually, as a writer, where do you go from that? Where do you find a subject that's as compelling after something like this that seems to be so central to who you are?
Well, the novel also takes family tragedy and changes that into fiction. That seems to be a rich place for me to write from. So it takes on the murder-suicide of my stepmother's parents. Her mother shot her father and then shot herself.
Which comes up very, very briefly, just in passing.
Right. It's in Rhoda in the second story here. And so I've developed that story out in the novel, but transposed it to Alaska instead of California, where it actually happened. And it has a second family story of my grandmother, who at age 10 came home and found her mother hanging from a rafter. And so that's in the background of the main character's story in the novel. But the whole thing's set in Alaska and made up. I mean, it really is, the entire thing is invented, as is the novella in here and most of this book. But my attempt is to find something in the fiction that's more true to the real life than what was actually lived.
So just a final question as you're here. it's very interesting to me that you take these events that happened in California and then bring them all back to Alaska again. Do you think you need the grandeur of setting, the grandeur of that setting, to set off these huge events? Is that why you've moved them back there?
I do think so. I think that isolation and wilderness, that it focuses in some ways the themes of what's happening with these characters who are isolated from one another and from themselves and their lives. So I think I do need that landscape.
David Vann with Sarah Crown. And Legend of a Suicide is published by Penguin. You can get it from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. That's it for this week's podcast. Thank you to our guests, Michael Peel, Taffy Thomas, and of course, David Vann and Sarah Crown. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Corley. Thanks for listening. Bye.